All right, everyone, it's 1 o'clock. We'll get started here. So I just want to welcome everybody to today's training, ITRC Strategies for Preventing and Managing Benthic Harmful Cyanobacteria Blooms. This training will be recorded and will be offered live for those not able to join us. The Cluin training page offers the slides available for download under download training materials. You can use the Q&A pod to ask questions, make comments, or report technical difficulties that you have at any time during training today. We will have a question and answer break at the end of today's training, and feel free to put any questions at any point in the training, and we will address those at the session at the end. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, ITRC's Strategies for Preventing and Managing Benthic Harmful Cyanobacteria Blooms. My name is Devin Sechkar. I'm your moderator today from Washington, D.C. This training is an introduction to the ITRC online guidance document of the same name produced by ITRC in 2022. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as Cluin. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of members from the federal government, state agencies, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you're participating on today. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On slide five, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers today. Not only were they members of the team, but they also have been volunteers on this training team and have made this training possible. So with that, I am going to pass it off to Gina LaLiberté from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. All right, Gina, take it away.
Let's see. All right. Great. We're advancing now. Well, thank you for joining us today. You might wonder why we developed a separate guidance document for benthic HCBs. This figure shows the overlap between the 2021 planktonic cyanobacteria guidance document, which we refer to as HCB1, and the 2022 benthic cyanobacteria guidance, which we refer to as HCB2. While much of the same guidance for planktonic HCBs applies to benthic HCBs, there are some unique differences between benthic and planktonic cyanobacteria that warranted development of the benthic HCB guidance document. Additionally, we have updated many of the resources from our planktonic HCB guidance document to cover both planktonic and benthic HCBs, which you see in this figure as the shared and updated resources where the two sets of guidance overlap. If you're not already familiar with cyanobacteria, we do recommend that you check out the HCB1 document, which covers planktonic cyanobacteria, and review the HCB1 online training. And you can find the introduction to benthic HCBs in section one of the benthic HCB guidance document. So today I'm going to be introducing the visual differentiation of benthic versus planktonic HCBs. I'll discuss the ecological differences of benthic versus planktonic HCBs with a focus on water clarity and nutrient levels. I'll review the habitats in which you find benthic HCBs. I will also briefly go over how these differences can present a challenge in both risk assessment and communication, which we're going to cover in more detail later on in this training. So to briefly review some basic information about all cyanobacteria, they are naturally occurring and are widely distributed across both aquatic and terrestrial environments. In both guidance documents, we focused on those in freshwater and estuary habitats. Cyanobacteria do have beneficial ecological roles, such as serving as food source for other organisms, providing oxygen via photosynthesis, and some are able to fix nitrogen, atmospheric nitrogen, into a form that's usable by algae and plants, and they use these specialized cells that you see indicated by this arrow. Cyanobacteria also have some unique characteristics that help them to form persistent blooms, including forming resting or dormant stages, such as this enlarged cell that you see indicated by the second arrow. Planktonic cyanobacteria, which float in the water column, can regulate their buoyancy using the gas vesicles that you see as the dark bodies in the cell indicated by the bottommost arrow. These are lacking in benthic cyanobacteria. However, benthic cyanobacteria can sometimes float due to the buildup of oxygen bubbles within their mats from photosynthesis. So what do benthic and planktonic cyanobacteria look like, and how can you tell them apart from other things in aquatic systems? We have a great visual guide to common harmful cyanobacteria in Appendix A of the guidance document, and the Learn to Identify Cyanobacteria Blooms video on the HCB2 homepage. These identification resources have field photographs of blooms and microscopic images, and they cover cyanobacteria by what form they grow in, such as in colonies or filaments, and by what habitat they grow in, such as planktonic in the water column, such as you see in the photo on the right, versus benthic, growing on surfaces or sediments on the bottom of aquatic habitats, such as in the photo on the left. The identification resources also include examples of aquatic plants, filamentous algae, other kinds of algae, and pollen that can be mistaken for accumulations of cyanobacteria. The appearance of benthic cyanobacteria is very different from that of planktonic HCBs. Benthic HCBs grow as attached or loosely associated mats or colonies that grow on bottom sediments or other substrates. Mat formers are typically filamentous species, while colonial species are often coccoid cyanobacteria. Many benthic mat-forming species are motile, so you can see individual filaments moving within the mat when observed with a microscope. These species can reconsolidate into a mat if they're disturbed. And as you see in these photos, the colors of benthic cyanobacteria tend to be darker, ranging from olive green to brown or even black, in contrast to the vivid blue-greens and other colors of decomposing planktonic blooms. These photos also illustrate a spectrum of growth forms, with thin crusts or mats in photo A, globular colonies in photo B, thick mats in photo C, and mats which are floating to the surface in photo D on the lower right. Benthic mat communities may be somewhat uniform, but it's also common to have very diverse microbial communities within mats. Mat communities may include a matrix of multiple cyanobacteria growing as filaments, colonial coccoid cyanobacteria, diverse bacteria, algae, and protists, all of which are often in constant movement within the mats. Planktonic blooms can also consist of multiple species and strains, but in comparison, benthic communities can be very diverse. For example, in this micrograph of a benthic mat from a lake in Wisconsin, in addition to multiple filamentous cyanobacterial taxa, the mat community also contains small spirochete bacteria, purple sulfur bacteria, a diatom, and a euglenoid cell. Cyanobacteria are photosynthetic, so benthic cyanobacteria tend to grow in clear water where light can reach them on the bottom. Additionally, some species have adaptations for growing in lower light at greater depths. The growth of benthic HCBs in clear water may seem counterintuitive when compared with planktonic HCBs, which tend to be more prevalent in high nutrient waters that are turbid from abundant phytoplankton growth. In this photo of a lake in Wisconsin with very clear water, you see dark cyanobacterial mats that have lifted off the bottom and are floating with the surrounding bright green mass of spirogyra filaments. Benthic HCBs can grow where surrounding waters contain low nutrient levels by taking up nutrients from sediment poor water or nutrients released from the aquatic macrophytes on which they grow. Cyanobacteria are diverse in their nutrient preferences, and there are many species, including benthic species, that grow better in low nutrient conditions. For example, benthic cyanobacteria are dominant in some nutrient poor, pristine, alpine, and Arctic water bodies. This is in contrast to planktonic HCBs, which tend to proliferate in eutrophic water bodies where high nutrient levels support their growth. Benthic HCBs can grow on undisturbed sediments and slow-moving pools of rivers. They can also grow on larger rocks and fast-moving river water, as in the upper photo, where they live in the narrow boundary layer below turbulent flow that would dislodge them. These flowing water habitats are very different in contrast to the stagnant waters that typically support planktonic bloom development and accumulation. Benthic HCBs can also grow in protected or deep areas in lakes and reservoirs, such as in the bottom photo, which shows a mat that has floated to the surface of a shallow protected bay in a Wisconsin lake. Benthic HCBs don't always stay in place. Oxygen production during photosynthesis affects their dispersion in water bodies. Oxygen production rates may be high enough in clear water that oxygen bubbles are formed and accumulate within mats, as you see in this photo at the top of Anabena in clear river water in California. If enough bubbles accumulate, the mats can lift off the substrate and are carried away by river flow. In lakes, the bubbles can lift mats off the sediments, as illustrated in the lower photo. Physical disturbance can also remove mats from substrates as well. In rivers, thick mats are vulnerable to removal due to increased drag and turbulence as mats grow out of the boundary layer and up into the flow. Mechanical disturbances such as wind, waves, boat wakes, and wading can also dislodge mats and allow them to be carried elsewhere passively by wind and currents. Some of the aspects of benthic HCBs I just reviewed can present challenges for communicating risk to the public and affect the public's ability to recognize benthic HCBs. We review this in more depth in the communication strategies in Section 5 of the HCB2 document. These challenges include the fact that the public may be only familiar with the appearance of planktonic HCBs. They may be unaware that benthic HCBs grow as mats or colonies, have muted dark colors, and appear to have lower apparent densities as floating mats or attached benthic mats in comparison to planktonic HCBs. The public may also expect HCBs to only grow in nutrient-impaired lakes or reservoirs with turbid, stagnant water rather than in flowing waters of streams or rivers or in water bodies with clear water and low nutrients. The challenges of identifying benthic HCBs also play a role in the challenges of communicating about toxins and risk assessment. Like planktonic HCBs, some benthic HCB species can produce toxins. Mats can pose a higher risk when ingested simply by their concentrated nature. Mats contain very high cell densities and therefore could possibly contain correspondingly high toxin concentrations. The risks can be higher for animals as they're more likely to ingest mats, either intentionally or accidentally by drinking water containing mat material, such as in the floating mats in the stream in the photo on the right. In the close-up photo of the 3-centimeter wide mat on the left, you can see how dense the dark filaments are at the mat edges. This mat probably contains hundreds of thousands of filaments with cell counts in the millions and potentially correspondingly high toxin concentrations. So next, we have Ruth Breland of the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency, who will be covering the updated toxin section.
Wonderful. Thank you, Gina. That was a great introduction. I'll make sure that I can advance our slide here. Perfect. So I am revisiting our Venn diagram framework for the HCB 1 and 2 documents here and highlighting the fact that cyanotoxins are considered a shared resource because they are produced by both planktonic as well as benthic cyanobacteria. And I will talk more generally in the following slides about cyanotoxins and also note the importance of threshold values that may be more likely, but try to highlight a few things that are important to our benthic HABs. So in the following bullet points here, I just want to note that they follow the organization of our cyanotoxins section. Thanks. I'll go ahead and pause, stop my video here just so you don't have to watch me flip back and forth. And we consider way first, we consider ways that humans and animals are potentially exposed to those cytotoxins and the health effects that are associated with different groups. We'll detail all the important considerations in terms of the distribution and stability, and for example, where, when, and for how long cytotoxins may persist in the environment. The guidance document, of course, goes into much more detail than what we can cover here, especially on the different classes, but I will just briefly introduce those on the presentation and finally focus on how we derive or calculate the threshold values. In terms of how humans can be exposed, we think of it first, are you directly associated with an affected water body? You can accidentally ingest cyanotoxins when you're swallowing water while you're swimming, or even there's been evidence of showing that the cyanotoxins and cyanobacteria can be picked up along with aerosols and water spray or mist. That's why activities like riding wave runners or something directly through a bloom can have, you know, is something we would recommend avoiding when there's a clear bloom. And we also have direct, when you have direct contact with the water and it gets on your skin, it can accumulate in areas, say, of your swimsuit. And so following good recommendations in terms of washing off with clean water after any type of exposure in swimming is recommended. But you can also be exposed when you're away from affected water bodies by ingesting any contaminated drinking water. Many large cities and places use surface water as a sources for drinking of water. I do want to note that the treatment is generally effective, but there are cases where we have found cyanotoxins detected in finished water. So that's one route of exposure, an important one for establishing threshold values. It can also be found in food in terms of fish or shellfish, and even supplements where they've, and that's actually been something that's been documented. And I would say it's a very active area of research. Animals can have additional exposure, as Gina said. One, they're certainly spending much more time and directly drinking untreated water. They may not only lack avoidance behaviors, but in fact be attracted to and have higher consumption of bloom or mat material like the cow pictured here. They, of course, can feed directly on cyanobacteria. It's one of the roles in the food web, as well as other prey fish that they may consume, like macroinvertebrates, the fish and the bugs that are present, and could contain cyanotoxins. In fact, we have documented bioaccumulation through the food web. In terms of domestic animals, too, there can be incidental ingestion from grooming behavior. So cyanobacteria can really embed themselves in the fur or feathers, and you can actually have a higher exposure. It's important, again, to have good recommendations to clean off your pets if they've been into swimming in any type of water that may have HABs. In terms of the health effects, again, there are broad classes of cyanotoxins due to the broad diversity of these groups. They can have different exposure. The targets, the cyanotoxins can target different organ systems, such as the liver with hepatotoxins or the nervous system. And we also include a set of irritants here as well that just may have general irritation. We haven't identified a specific toxin associated with it. Again, the cyanotoxin section, we present much more specific details on the different classes, along with information on those health effects. The most common, and of course, the health effects or symptoms are similarly broad, but the most commonly reported are nausea, or general gastrointestinal problems, fatigue, exhaustion, lethargy, as well as skin irritation like rashes and itching. And those can be associated with either specific cyanotoxin or just general exposure to the cyanobacteria. Unfortunately, there have been documented cases of animal illness as well as death, particularly for dogs that are directly associated with cyanotoxins. And as I mentioned, there has been evidence of bioaccumulation in the food web and is still an active area of research. In terms of cyanotoxin distribution and stability, it, just as Gina mentioned, the blooms can be quite variable over space and time. That's true with toxin production as well. Just because we see in multiple toxins may be associated or produced by a single species of cyanobacteria. The other end of the spectrum, not all cyanobacteria are either capable or actively producing toxins. Pictures noted here, we may be able to see what we can see out in the field, like the filaments covering that rock. We get under the microscope and say, yes, this is the type of cyanobacteria commonly associated with maybe specific cyanotoxins, but we don't know if it's actively producing those toxins or not. Other key factors to consider about distribution stability are that toxins are generally held within the cyanobacteria cells themselves and referred to as intracellular toxins. It's kind of depicted here on the cartoon and the top filament with the little diamond red cyanotoxins kept inside the cell. However, there is one exception, notably for Snellius-Dropsin, which is actively exported outside of the cell. And when these toxins are released into the water, it can be referred to as extracellular or dissolved cyanotoxins, which can be released naturally when cells die, or if there's a chemical treatment like an algicide applied that would cause a quicker cell lysis. Or when those cells are ingested, they may actually break down and be released once they've been consumed. We do present degradation rates in our document, and it's important to note that these are for the extracellular form of the toxin, and it can vary widely. Some are quite quick to degrade, may only last a few hours to days, or can proceed for months. And in terms of what's found inside the cell, well, as long as that cell is intact, it can persist. So there's been samples and evidence pulled from sediments where you can still detect that cyanotoxin. In terms of our classes of cyanotoxins, I do note that there are many structural forms, and that's why many of our specific classes are plural. In the case of microcystins, we have several hundred structural variants, also known as congeners, that have been documented. And the little red diamond is also helping to indicate which ones, the four large classes or groups for which we have published threshold values. There are many of which we don't, including those dermatoxins or skin irritants. And one of the reasons we only have cyanotoxin thresholds derived or developed for a few of those is because you need quite a bit of information. And this is built on the kind of concept that there is a level at which you can be exposed and have no negative or adverse health effects during what we consider a typical exposure. And that's going to take into account how much water may be consumed or the typical exposure length of an activity. Generally, the threshold values are presented as the concentration in that toxin per either volume, like water, or in biomass, such as with mat material, or if you were consuming something like a fish. Components of that equation are the reference doses, and we need published values of toxicity. Need to incorporate certain uncertainty factors in terms of the population that the reference dose or study may be associated with. And then, of course, things related to your exposure. So how much water is typical to drink in a day? How much water would you typically be exposed to? And I mention that because this is where different threshold values may differ among groups, agencies, states, or references. And also noting that cyanotoxins can be associated with different lengths of time. It may just be an acute, say, single exposure. In the cases of microcystins, we look at short-term or a 10-day exposure. And in other cases, they look at what's the exposure over the course of a lifetime. The figures shown here on the right, those pictures are directly from our HCB guidance document. They're right at the top of the cyanotoxin section, and they are also interactive hyperlinks. So you can click on it directly and take you to, say, the drinking water threshold section associated with humans or the mat material value associated with domestic animals. So rather than show a plot or a table here, just wanted to make sure that you could access that material from our guidance document. In terms of regulation and guidance, it's important to note we still do not have federal standards, such as like a maximum contaminant level that for either cyanobacteria or specific cyanotoxins. However, USCBA has published threshold values for two types of cyanotoxins, the microcystins and Snellius-Dropsin, for both recreational and drinking water. Many states have then adopted these thresholds and or developed their own regulatory guidance. And that is kind of shown in the two figures of the states where we've got the four different types of cyanotoxins, which states have adopted or derived values of their own. And that was, of course, taken at the time over a year, almost a year ago now, when we did this assessment. And of course, the World Health Organization has developed guidance for microcystin, LR, enotoxin A, solidosporopsin, and saxitoxin in recent years. It's one of the things that spurred us including it in the update of this document. In terms of a case study, I do want to mention how the cyanotoxin thresholds in MAP material, it's a case study from our document. And while no threshold exists for human consumption, because in general, we don't anticipate humans eating MAP material directly. In this example, they integrated the recreational water and MAP threshold values. So they modified the sampling protocol to be considered a benthic disturbance, where they would go in and actively kick up and disturb the benthic material so that it may come up into the water and then sample that water sample in order to get a value to compare with the thresholds in water. In addition to that, they had passive sampling for the presence of extracellular toxins and even included tiered advisory. Additional information. So MAP-based thresholds for both dogs and cattle based on dry weight concentration. And now I will pass it on to Thea Fredrickson to talk more about monitoring. Thank you.
Perfect. So I will get control of the screen here in 1 second. Perfect. Okay. Hi, everyone. So the goal for this portion of the training is to understand some key differences when monitoring for benthic versus planktonic HCPs. I'm also going to go over the method selection tool that has been updated since HCP2, and then I will discuss the basics of creating a benthic HCP monitoring plan and discussing the differences between a monitoring plan and a response plan. And hopefully by the end of today's training, you'll have a basic understanding of how to monitor for benthic HCPs. I think one of the main questions a lot of people will have is how does monitoring for a benthic HCB differ from monitoring for planktonic HCBs? A lot of you may already have a monitoring plan in place for planktonic blooms, and you're wondering how you can incorporate benthics into your existing monitoring plan. One of the first key and most obvious differences is in planktonic monitoring plans, the first step is often to conduct a visual assessment to confirm whether a bloom is present. And while that may work very well for the obvious planktonic blooms, as shown here on the left, it can be a little bit more difficult when dealing with benthic HCBs because they can be more cryptic in nature, as you can see in the photo on the right. Because of their benthic location and kind of cryptic natures, benthic HCBs often require specialized tools to help researchers obtain visual aids. And that will be something like a bathyscope, as shown here. And so in addition to needing specialized equipment to actually lay eyes on a benthic bloom, if you want to accurately characterize your bloom and collect a better sample, you'll need additional tools to help you sample the bottom or the surface, the sediment of your lake or river. And so that can require specialized tools such as a Ponar dredge seen here or a rake, essentially any tool that can allow you to bring benthic material up to the surface. Another key difference when monitoring the two types of blooms is the actual sample you're going to collect in the field. Planktonic samples generally consist of either water or foam, whereas using a water sample for a benthic bloom can be misleading. As we mentioned in the toxin section, benthic HCBs often contain most of their toxins within the mat material. Therefore, to accurately characterize a benthic bloom, you'll want to collect a composite sample of either mats or periphyton scrapings. And so another method that you could use is using something called artificial substrate, as seen in the picture on the right, that you can deploy to study site and consistently collect mat and periphyton material from. Additionally, once your samples are collected, it's important to note that different cyanotoxins and toxin congeners are more commonly associated with benthic blooms than with planktonic blooms. Therefore, you may need to order additional tests that help you screen for potentially toxigenic species. And these screens can help you ID the species that are present in your sample, and then you'll know what toxins are more commonly associated with those species. Thankfully, though, the underlying process and method of analyzing toxins for benthics and planktonics is very similar. Therefore, if you already have a lab that you're using with ELISA or LC-MS/MS, you can continue to use those laboratory methods for your benthic samples. You may just have a small change in how they initially process mat versus water samples. Another key thing to really point out when monitoring for benthic HCBs is that while threshold guidelines exist for some common cyanotoxins that occur in both planktonic and benthic bloom, those guidelines generally apply to water samples. As I pointed out above, generally in benthic cases, you would be more interested in testing the mat to truly capture whether cyanotoxins are present or not. So keep that in mind. While there are no guidelines for your specific toxins in mat material, we are working on it. Okay, so while those current toxin threshold values and guidelines are geared towards those planktonic water samples, there are other ways to characterize a benthic bloom. Percent cover can be used to help you determine the extent of a benthic bloom. And to do that, you would use a quadrat of a known size shown here, and you would monitor an area over time. Once that area hits certain coverage levels, it can help spur different action levels. So the New Zealand government is a great example. They use percent cover to determine when they will actually start testing benthic material for toxins. And this is a great example of a field method that can be used for benthic HCBs, but does not apply to planktonic blooms. So I'm going to kind of switch gears a little bit, and we'll start talking about building a monitoring plan. And there are going to be several important steps for your monitoring plan, whether it's geared towards planktonics or benthics or both. So first and foremost, you're going to need to decide what your overall monitoring goal is, because your overall goal is going to influence which factors you monitor for. If public safety is your main concern, then you might be more interested in monitoring for cyanotoxins as opposed to cyanobacteria cell per mil. But if you're more interested in bloom trends, then you might be more interested in how often and what abundant cyanobacteria cells are present. Additionally, up front, you'll really want to consider your budget and the level of training you're willing to invest in your monitoring program. But luckily for you, HCB2 has an updated tool that can help you decide which methods can give you the information you need, as well as estimates of your costs for monitoring. And so this is going to be a screenshot of our tool that we have on HCB2. And as you can see, you can go ahead and click your target analyte when you're using this tool to help you look at methods that are good for either planktonic cyanobacteria, for benthic cyanobacteria, or just for cyanotoxins. And it will go out here and it will list these different methods that can be used. And it can tell you whether or not those methods are good for presence or absence, or maybe for identification, for density and abundance. Additionally, for your cyanotoxins, it can tell you presence, absence, it can tell you congeners, or it can tell you relative total cyanotoxins in a sample. It'll give you more information like result type, sample type, and it'll show you those relative costs and level of training. Since this is the benthic training, you could go ahead and unclick planktonics, and now you'll only get methods that are giving you a good idea about benthic cyanobacterias. You could click again, and now we'll only see methods that relate towards cyanotoxin levels and concentrations. So that's a great tool. Highly recommend you check it out. So once you decide on the type of data that you're really interested in collecting, it's important to ensure that your field methods are also going to complement your goals. But we also have a table for that. So again, if you go to HCB2, this table can help you narrow down which field methods help to match your goals. So for instance, if your goal is to have a monitoring program that incorporates both planktonics and benthics, as well as looking at the cyanotoxin and the cyanobacterial mass, you'll say, oh, a field method for that would be a grab sample. It could help me look at all of those things. Or if you're interested in just cyanotoxins, maybe you would use something like a passive sampler seen here that could still help you look at planktonic and benthics. And you can also look at what different water body types these field methods work in, as well as potential locations, shoreline, surface water, below surface water, what depths you want to reach. I highly recommend you check out this tool to ensure that your field methods are going to line up with your monitoring plan goals. After you decide on your field methods, you're going to need to start thinking about the practical things like sites in which you'll conduct your monitoring and how frequently you will sample. And again, this plays back into what your overall goal is. So if public safety is your concern, you might consider areas that have high recreation potential, such as along a shoreline, and you might want to sample weekly or biweekly to keep the public informed on water conditions. If you're interested in bloom ecology, perhaps you'd want to pick a more undisturbed area out in the open water that isn't influenced by recreators with benthic disturbances. And then most importantly, if you do implement a monitoring program, what response will your organization have if typical monitoring results show cyanotoxin or cyanobacteria levels that exceed existing threshold guidelines? And this is when that monitoring plan kind of turns into a response plan. And so a response plan is going to be a separate set of actions your organization will take in response to certain HCB-related events. These events can include monitoring results that exceed threshold guidelines. They could be a reported dog death or illness. They could be a fish kill or even a visible bloom, as shown in this photo. Your response plan should outline what you're going to do in case these events occur. If these events do occur and you sample, what level of either cyanobacteria or cyanotoxin results in what next step? And then, of course, what is that response going to be? So you really need to think about, does your organization have the ability to close down an area that is experiencing a bloom? Do you have capabilities to implement nutrient management? All of these questions are important to ask yourself as you construct your response plan. It's really easy to respond to one bloom report or one dog illness report, but you need to think long term about sustainability. Can your organization afford, either in terms of budget or manpower, to go out and respond to every single bloom call that they get? You really want to think about these things ahead of time so that you have a consistent response based on the HCB-related event. And so to kind of wrap up this discussion on monitoring, I really want you to remember to think about what your goals are in your monitoring plan. I would highly suggest that you use that selection tools that I've just showed you to help you determine what methods, both field and lab, can help you get the goals that support your monitoring plan. And then again, I would also advise that you devise a response plan before you need it and you be consistent with your responses to certain HCB-related events. And of course, always be realistic about monitoring and response capabilities. And with that, I'm going to pass it on to Ben Holcomb of the Utah Department of Environmental Quality to talk about management.
All right. Thank you so much, Thea. I'll be covering shortly, quickly, our management strategy tool, and then I'll follow up immediately with our communication and bloom response planning portion of the document and training. So first, this topic here that I'm covering is found in section 4 of the document. And the goal of this section is to assemble management strategies for treating HCBs, including benthic HCBs in the water body. So this encompasses both preventative and intervening approaches. The section is supported with an interactive selection tool to help you identify the most applicable treatment strategies and a compilation of fact sheets that describes the pros and cons of each strategy. So essentially, this section 4, it's a recast of section 6 from our previous study, our previous document, HCB1. It contains all the same features of the web portal as identified in the HCB1 training, such as the strategy compiled hot linked table with the PDF document download, as seen here on the right on table 4.1. And I'm just going to give you a brief overview of the changes that we did to the tool. So I'm going to cover the specific changes that occurred in the interactive selection tool. If you want a more complete review of the tool and all its features and more in depth on it, check out the HCB1 management and control strategies training module, which is archived on our web portal. All right, first, the management strategy selection tool has been cross-linked to that first document, HCB1. So both documents share the same tool. What you're looking at here is a screenshot of the tool. And it's primarily been reconfigured so it's easier to use. Essentially, the number of selection categories have been reduced. Because we're including benthic bloom habitat, rivers have also been added as a water body type, as you'll see here on the top. The variables that were initially part of the selection category have been provided as part of the table information, such as the level of supporting peer-reviewed documentation, which you can find here, along with the physical attributes of a water body for which the strategy is applicable in this section here. These are the variables. And then, of course, the strategy fact sheets that are hot linked in the tool now include benthic-related content. So that's all I really needed to cover for the management tool. But please give that a review, check it out, give us some feedback. We'd appreciate it. So next, I'm going to move on to our communication and response planning strategies. So the goal of the communication response planning section of this document is to assemble the best practices, resources, and examples of response planning and communicating benthic HGBs to your stakeholders, and also internally within your own agencies. The general practices provided in this section are found in section 5 of the web portal, and the associated training are unchanged with respect to benthic blooms. But today I'll cover a few specific areas where new practices should be considered when addressing benthic HGBs in your jurisdiction. During this training, I'm going to cover companion information to HGB2 communication response planning in these areas, specifically reporting, notification, and coordination, visual observation and identification, drinking water coordination planning, advisories, outreach, and signage. And I'll first start off with the reporting notification coordination piece. So a first good practice would be to consider new potential water bodies. As you learned from the introduction section, benthic HGBs are more likely to occur in water bodies that are clear, or they may be found in flowing waters like streams and rivers. So after completing this process, there are likely new key partners, stakeholders, and agencies that have connections to these waters. And now is a good time to begin including those stakeholders into your HGB planning activities. Next is incorporate new information as provided from the introduction section, such as the habitat and characteristics and toxins that are associated with benthic HGBs, into your outreach and education programs. Incorporate benthic blooms into your overall public outreach, particularly with emphasis on the exposure risks of mats versus water, as you've have been hearing about. And then also include frequently associated toxins. Finally, ensure that you inform stakeholders and respective agency partners related to recreation, drinking water, agricultural, and livestock producers. To assist your coordination efforts of incorporating this new information, we've added new benthic HGB imagery to our visual guide that was developed in HGB1. And we also created a new identification video. So ensure your communication plans are evaluated and emphasized to your stakeholders and collaborators of this new paradigm that benthic blooms can be found in clearer waters or flowing waters like streams and rivers, and not simply eutrophic waters. In addition, as mentioned in the monitoring training, there are new field and lab approaches to consider. So point your collaborators to the monitoring and toxin sections of the document and the respective trainings to understand those specific challenges and approaches to address benthic blooms in your area. In regards to drinking water sources, so the information that I just covered regarding bloom identification, habitats, and monitoring should be directly coordinated with your drinking water providers. For instance, we recommend reviewing the plans with drinking water providers to ensure they address the nuance that benthic blooms create. And as for private drinking water sources, it would be a good practice to identify and develop outreach materials as it relates to their specific needs and capabilities. So for more information on this, visit section 5.1.3. We've got great examples and links to resources that can assist you. All right. So regarding your state or tribe's health advisory processes and guidance, it's important to evaluate these existing documents, particularly the advisory thresholds you already have in place. We've discussed this critical review in the previous training modules, but due to the nature of benthic blooms, particularly how a sample may be collected, it's difficult to compare existing thresholds you might have. Specifically, federal criteria are based as a concentration, whereas a benthic sample that you collect is more likely to be reported as a unit of mass across an area. So what do you do about that? You either need to modify your sampling technique to generate a concentration-based sample, or you need to determine an appropriate threshold guidance value for an area-based sample. So either way, it's important to incorporate this information into your existing guidance so that your agency partners, your stakeholders, and the public understand this nuance. In addition, as mentioned in the toxins training module, benthic blooms tend to include large concentrations of antitoxin A and its variants. Due to the unstable nature of these toxins outside of the cell, you'll often encounter scenarios of low toxin levels in the water and extremely high levels in the mats. So there's no federal recommended thresholds for antitoxin A or variants or those found in a mat, for example. So this part that I'm going to say next is really important, so that ensure that the measures you collect are appropriate to issue an advisory under your current approach. And if not, what mechanisms or procedures are appropriate to issue advisories for benthic blooms in your area? So specifically, reevaluate your approaches to post advisories for benthic blooms and how those designs can impact, or those decisions can impact, your current approach, from using signage, press releases, your website information, and your social media outreach. We've got great guidance examples and resources like this table from Zion National Park here that you see on your screen. And for more information, check out section 5.1.4. So in regards to signage, the guidance recommends emphasizing and translating visually the differences of mats versus water, and the higher risks to pets and livestock producers due to those different matrices. For instance, if you haven't updated your guidance to accommodate how advisories would be formally issued, you might want to consider creating an alert or outreach signs to inform the public when these blooms are present and the risks they pose. See section 5.1.5 for examples and resources like this sign from the California HAB network. So I've just covered a few of the specifics, but besides those examples and the compiled resources we provided throughout this section, there are also three case studies found in Appendix B that I'd like to point you towards. And they provide more contextual information on this topic. We have an example from Lake Travis in Texas, the highly visited Virgin River in Zion National Park, and the Russian River in California. And the diversity of these case studies, both ecologically and their approaches, should provide useful context to your program. So I'd encourage you to visit these examples. And then finally, here's a list of all the available resources for you to consider. You've seen this presented throughout this training session, but I'm gonna walk you through these a little bit more broadly. All of these can be accessed from this diagram found on our HCB2 homepage. So we've got our communication and response planning that I just covered. We have this shared resource of learning to recognize HCBs, both in a video and a visual guide. Each section has specific recommendations. As I mentioned just a minute ago, we've got a section dedicated to case studies, and then we've got the management strategy selection tool and the monitoring method selection tool. And all this information can be found at the link that you see highlighted there, hcb-2.itrcweb.org. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Devin for questions.
All right, thank you, Ben. At this time, we will open our question and answer portion of the training, and then we will wrap up. So looking to the Q&A pod here, what factors do you think attribute to, and I apologize if I say this incorrectly, lingba balls forming at certain times of the year?
Yeah, this is Gina. I can take that question. So I think this might be specifically about Lingbia wolii, which actually has an updated name now. You can find it in the visual guide on the website as Microcyra wolii. So this is a large filamentous cyanobacterium, and it can form balls. There are actually other cyanobacteria and other algae that grows filaments that can form balls. And I think the mechanism is the same for all of them. What they need is sort of a gentle wave action that rolls them around on the bottom of a lake, and they just kind of form into balls. I mean, if you do fiber arts, it's sort of the same as felting fibers and just rolling around it. They form these balls, and then as they photosynthesize, as oxygen bubbles accumulate within those balls, they float to the surface. I know that these can be really prominent in Western Lake Erie. Sometimes there are so many balls that form that they get washed up on shore, and they can form pretty deep muck. But I have seen them in lakes around the Madison, Wisconsin area as well. And I know I've seen balls forming out of another cyanobacterium genus called Tollypothrix. But there's also filamentous greens, in particular Egagropula, which is a former species of Cladophora, that can also form these balls just by rolling around on the bottom. So I can't tell you specifically what conditions, but in general, I think you just need to have kind of gentle wave action that laps them around on the bottom, and they turn into little algae balls.
All right. Thank you, Gina. Next question. Are benthic mats permanent, or can they eventually go away on their own? If there are no planktonic blooms, should drinking water suppliers be concerned?
I can go ahead and answer this. So benthic mats generally are not permanent. They go through a cycle, and typically they can be easily disturbed, I would say. So if new flows are apparent, so if you have a seasonal water cycle, based on snow melt or a seasonality with your flows, they can easily be disrupted that way. Also, they just change and will eventually decay through the winter time. They won't be getting enough light. Generally, they'll start to die off in late summer and early fall, and that's when we tend to see them floating to the surface and traveling downstream. And then in regards to drinking water facilities, I think it's important that they be aware of benthic cyanobacteria because they can be they're innocuous looking. They're not visually apparent like we see on planktonic blooms forming these large surface mats. They generally can be kind of unnoticed or undernoticed. So I think it's really important that your drinking water providers are aware of benthic blooms, particularly with their source water. So.
All right. Thank you, Ben. Next question. Can you explain the difference between HABs and HCBs? Do HABs also produce toxins? Ruth, I think that you were going to answer this one.
Yes, absolutely. That's a great question and something that we do cover in our introduction and our overview. And it really comes down to terminology. The term algae is actually more of a generic or eclectic term. It's not specific to kind of the different classes or groups. It's more broad and would include taxonomic groups from green algae, diatoms, even dinoflagellates. And it's also associated with blooms in marine systems. And so we knew with this document, we really wanted to focus in on freshwater systems. And typically it's the cyanobacteria that are the biggest group that are associated with toxins and of concern. So we were very specific in our terminology to say harmful cyanobacteria blooms. I will say sometimes when you're talking about algae, they highlight that, you know, those other groups are specifically include groups that are eukaryotic cells, meaning they've got a nucleus, other organelles, whereas cyanobacteria is more, you know, an older organism, it lacks those and it does, you know, group with true bacteria. So sometimes people like to present this, you know, separate groups is like good algae and bad cyanobacteria, but I think it just comes down to terminology here.
All right, thank you, Ruth. Next question. In the example of Zion, it seems like the antitoxin levels were very high before a warning. Is this because the benthic solid samples were very concentrated with toxins, or upper rec threshold is about one? I apologize. I am not familiar with the terminology for the units of measurement.
Microgram per liter.
Microgram per liter. Thank you, Ben, for warning. Can you elaborate on this?
Yeah, I can attempt my best answer on this one. I presume that you're comparing differences in guidance values across different regions. So for example, in Zion, they may have a higher threshold before they would issue a warning. And I think there may be differences across regions on how a warning advisory is administered or implemented. So I do know that Zion National Park, they'll also issue a warning that precedes, or I should say, they will issue an advisory that would precede a warning that they call a health watch. And that's similar to, I would suspect, some folks might call as a caution or even a warning. That kind of terminology varies across states, regions, and administrations. And so they do have a lower threshold where they would issue a health watch to alert the public to the presence of cyanotoxins. A warning is another heavier hand where they'd probably, you know, ensure that the public be mindful about that the public avoid swimming or full body immersion. So that might be the difference there across different jurisdictions.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Ben. We only have time for two more questions and they're in the Q&A pod. So I'll read those and then we'll wrap up the training. Do you have any advice for removing benthic cyano material like many folks do with green filamentous algae, or is the best advice to leave it alone until it naturally degrades?
Yeah, this is Gina. I would recommend taking a close look at some of the considerations in our management section. It would kind of depend on how you're using that particular area. One thing I would note that is, since you're dealing with microorganisms that are forming macroscopic growths, you really have to be careful about if you're trying to remove those macroscopic growths, are you inadvertently breaking them up and breaking them up into smaller pieces that are then much more difficult to corral and control and remove. As far as chemical treatments for them, you have to be very careful about that as well. This is covered in our management section. You don't want to, say, add a chemical treatment that would kill everything. And if those cells contain toxins, they could potentially release all the toxins that are intracellular as extracellular or dissolved toxins in one big slug. So definitely check out the management section for some considerations.
All right. Thank you, Gina. Last question here. Should one avoid swimming regardless of the type of algae?
Hi, I can take that one. So there is a lot of regular green algae that exist in a system all of the time. So if you avoid swimming because there's any algae, then you will never swim. So I would suggest to just don't swim through a patch of algae. And I would suggest never letting dogs eat any algal material you see when they're out and about. And that'll be the best way to keep everybody safe.
All right. Thank you, Thea. So with that, we're going to wrap up our training here today. I'd just like to take a moment to say thank you to our attendees for joining us today. And thank you to our expert trainers for not only volunteering on this team, but being here today to make this training possible. We would really like to hear back from everybody today on how the training went. So please be sure to fill out a feedback form, even if you don't need a certificate of completion. I did put the link in the chat for everybody, but it will also, once the webinar closes, you will be brought to the Clumen training page to complete that feedback form. If you have any questions or further questions or would like any clarification on any questions or answers provided, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org. You're also welcome to connect with our trainers directly. Their information is on the Clumen training page. So with that, I'm going to wish everybody a great rest of their day, and I hope to see some of you again in future trainings. Thank you so much.